Okay, why don't we get started? Thank you very much, everyone, for coming to the meeting today. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Dave Scriven-Young. I'm an attorney at a law firm called Picar & Abramson. We have an office here in Chicago. I practice environmental law. And my practice is basically what you would normally expect general environmental practitioner to be. I do general litigation. I do some transactional work and some compliance work as well. And the topic today of my presentation is about environmental audit policies. And I'm sure a lot of you know about environmental audit policies. This is meant to be sort of a very basic, going through the conditions, giving you some updates as to what's new in environmental audit policies, and then I'll take any questions that you might have. Oftentimes, the audit policy comes up because a client will come to you and say, well, we know that we might have an environmental issue. We had a discharge. We think that we may have gone over emissions limitations. What do we do? On the other hand, you might have a client who says, well, we don't know if we have a problem, and how do we go about finding out about whether we have an environmental issue without getting ourselves in trouble with the environmental agencies and without exposing us to liability. And so that's where the audit policy comes in. So if we go to the second slide, what we're going to talk about today is, number one, what is an environmental audit? Number two, how can businesses take advantage of US EPA's audit policy? And then we're going to talk about Illinois' environmental audit law and why you might want to take advantage of the state audit law and in addition to the EPA policy or instead of. So what is an environmental audit? Well, basically, in a nutshell, you're trying to find out whether your facility is in compliance with environmental regulations, statutes, and accepted standards. So the basic definition is a systematic, objective evaluation of facility activities for a finite review period. So let's break that down. Systematic. Usually, in an ideal world, environmental audits are done systematically. There's a process in place. You hire people to come in, and you have standards that you're looking at, and you're not basically just not going through the facility saying, oh, well, this may be right, this may be wrong, but you actually have a written down procedure of what you're going to do when you perform the audit. Objective. You want to have an objective evaluation of your facilities. In other words, you don't want to have a very low-level person in your facility doing these audits. I'm not saying they should never look at and make sure they're doing the right thing. That's not what I'm saying. But for purposes of the audit policy, what you want is you want to have objective proof that your facility is doing things right, and maybe have some issues that they want to reveal to the agency. And then finally, for a finite review period, this is going to be a snapshot of what is going on in your facility at this point in time. It is helpful to look historically and see what issues you've had in the past and whether you have been able to fix those issues. But this is just a snapshot of what's going on in your facility at this time. So what you're doing is you're verifying compliance with regulations, your internal policies and accepted practices. You're evaluating the effectiveness of your own environmental management systems. And then you're identifying and assessing any risks associated with potential non-compliance at your facility. And here are just some of the goals of environmental audit. So you're going to identify and document facility compliance status. And that means both your deficiencies, your facility shortcomings, as well as what you're doing right. And it's important to document both. Improve overall environmental performance. So if you have a regularly scheduled environmental audit, this is going to provide an incentive for people to permanently resolve environmental issues. So if you know that you have X problem during one audit, you know at the next audit, you don't want to have to see that same problem. And it gives you an incentive to fix whatever issues you have. Next, you're assisting the facility management to identify and compliance issues and solutions. And you're also assisting in figuring out what sort of training your employees need. You're identifying and assessing environmental risks, both in terms of risks to your employees, but also risks to the broader environment. You're optimizing resources. So you're figuring out how to effectively use your employees and your management processes to comply with environmental laws. You're providing assurance to senior management. Senior management wants to be assured that you're complying with regulations, not only because it's the right thing to do, but also to prevent liability exposure that your company or facility might face because of issues at your facility. And then finally, increase environmental awareness throughout the company. So in other words, you want to demonstrate that the management of the company is committed to environmental compliance and also to increase awareness of environmental issues throughout the facility. So what help does a company need to conduct an environmental audit? Well, it really depends on the company. Here are some of the people that you might get involved. And what I mean is by it depends on the company. You know, if you have a very large company, you know, Fortune 500 company, they probably have a lot of these people and processes in place. If this is a small business or medium-sized business, they may not have a lot of these components, and so they may have to go to the outside. Hopefully, all businesses, you know, they have someone, the plant manager, someone in charge of environmental health and safety. But two people that, or two individuals who might assist in this process are, number one, your outside environmental consultant. These are the people who are going to provide that objective analysis of exactly what's going on with your facility. They can help you both put together a compliance program, but also put together an environmental audit process so that it's regular and so that it's systematic. And attorneys should also be involved. Number one, you have a privilege issue. If you're an attorney, you're communicating with management, you are hiring, as an attorney, you're hiring environmental consultants, you have an argument that communications between yourself and management, between yourself and the consultants, are privileged, both attorney-client privilege or work product scenario, if you believe that it might go to litigation. So that's why attorneys are involved. Attorneys are also helpful in drafting audit policy letters, and we'll get to that as we go through this presentation. And also, attorneys are helpful in negotiating with the agencies. So if an audit policy is written and agency comes back and says, well, you know, we need to find out more information or we have questions, an attorney is helpful in negotiating and communicating with the agencies so the company management is just not out on their own. So let's turn to US EPA's audit policy. Now, here is the site for the policy itself, and actually the US EPA website does a really fantastic job of providing a lot of great information other than just what the policy says. It provides information on who audit policy letters should be sent to and exactly what they look for. There's a draft response letter that US EPA has, a template letter, I should say, that US EPA has a response letter where they ask for more information. A lot of great stuff on the website, so I encourage all of you to check that out if you're interested in finding out more. But basically, the goal of the policy is to give businesses the incentive to self-report violations. And they do that by providing significant reductions in potential penalties for those violations if a number of conditions are met by the facility. So here are the benefits of the audit policy. So take it one step back. So there are basically two different types of penalties that US EPA gives out. The first is what I call gravity-based. Gravity is basically what harm was caused because of the violation, either environmental harm or whether employees were injured or property was damaged because of the violation. The second is economic benefit. So if you have, if the facility did not comply with a certain regulation because they were trying to save money, and they did save money because they didn't do something they were supposed to, that is an economic benefit that the facility received. And so there are 9 conditions, and we'll go through each of those as to 9 conditions of the audit policy. And if the company meets all 9 of the policy's conditions, then there are no gravity-based penalties. And so basically the only penalty that the EPA can retain the ability to collect is the economic benefit portion of the penalty. Now, one of the conditions, and we'll get to this, is whether the violation was discovered through what they call a systematic discovery process. And if that element is not met, then the reduction is only 75% on a gravity-based penalty instead of full 100%. And then finally, the last two benefits are EPA, if the conditions are met, does not recommend criminal prosecution for the actions, and they do not have routine requests for audit reports. In other words, they won't say, well, I want to see your audit reports on a regular basis to make sure that you're in compliance, because if you're not and your audit policy shows otherwise, then we're going to prosecute you. We're going to go after you with enforcement action. They can't ask for those reports under the audit policy. So the first condition is what they call a systematic discovery of the violation through an environmental audit or a compliance management system. Now this is key because a lot of times clients will come to you and say, well, we know that we had a problem at our facility. You know, we're already in violation. What do we do? Do we tell the agency, or do we keep it to ourselves, or what do we do? And so, as I said, there's a different penalty based on whether or not you can fulfill this first condition. And so we talked about what environmental auditing is, and so if you discover it through a regularly scheduled environmental audit, then you're in good shape. As long as the rest of the conditions are met, of course. But this is sometimes the hardest this is a hard condition to meet for a lot of companies because they don't have regularly scheduled audits at their facilities. So an audit or a compliance management system, and this is a little bit more complicated, and there are a lot of different factors as to what goes into a compliance management system. It basically means that there are certain policies and procedures in place that dictate environmental compliance at the facility. And you have to show that these policies were in place. You have to show that the responsibility for complying with those procedures had been assigned to someone in management to oversee the process. You have to show that there were mechanisms for ensuring that the policies were followed or being carried out, and that would include things like monitoring or even through auditing systems, so maybe not on a such grander environmental auditing scale. You have to show that you've been communicating those policies and procedures to employees, that you've been training your employees on all of that, and that you have put in incentives in place for management and for company employees to comply, and also that you have a system in place that you're promptly correcting violations. So as I said, it's a very complicating factor, and this is the condition that trips up a lot of companies. So the second condition is voluntary discovery of the violation. So in other words, there are a lot of legally required mechanisms for trying to find out what's going on in your facility. You might have a permit, for example, that says, you know, thou shalt do a certain amount of monitoring or sampling your facility. If that's in place and your facility trips up on that, then you cannot get the incentives under the policy. If it's something that's legally required, you were supposed to be doing anyway, then you can't fulfill this condition. The third is prompt disclosure of the violation. So you have 21 calendar days after discovery to give disclosure of the violation in writing to USCPA. And that isn't just it's not as easy as it sounds. It means the definition that they give is whether an officer, director, employee, or agent of the facility has an reasonable basis for believing that a violation has occurred. So it's not, we know for sure that a violation has occurred because here's a sampling. It's a more loose standard than that. You have to have an objectively reasonable basis for believing that a violation has taken place. And then 21 calendar days after that, or within that amount of time, you must give disclosure of the violation in writing. The fourth is discovery and disclosure of independent of a government or a third-party plaintiff. So I have the bear looking into the museum, right? And so this happens a lot with companies where you have people always looking over your shoulder. You have agencies looking in. You have citizen groups who might be trying to figure out, you know, what's going on in your facility because you're, they think you're doing something wrong in the community and you're harming people. All these people are peering in. And you might get a notice of a citizen suit in the mail. You might get a notice of violation from the agency. You might be inspected by federal or state or even local agency. If the agencies or citizen groups find out something and provide notice of that to you, you can't then turn around and say, oh, I'm going under the audit policy and, you know, I deserve a penalty reduction. No. It has to be, you're discovering that totally independent of all of these different groups who are peering into your facility and trying to find out what you're doing wrong. So this is an important part of the process as well. So number five is correcting or remediating the problem within 16 calendar days from the date of discovery. And it says in most cases, because there are situations in which EPA may tell you, we want you and you have to get this done in less time than 60 days. On the other hand, you might say, well, look, it's technically impossible for me to get into compliance within 60 days. You know, can I have more time? And the policy allows for those type of conversations to take place. But you have to make sure, if you're going to ask for more time, make sure that you're asking for more time before your time expires. That's an important key to that. Number six, you have to agree to take steps to prevent recurrence of the violation. And this is basically a statement within your audit policy letter that says, you know, we're going to prevent recurrence of the violation by doing XYZ, by putting in place environmental audits, by retraining our employees, by putting a member of senior management on this problem. Number seven. So sometimes there are repeat violations. The question is, well, can you get can you take advantage of the audit policy if you had a repeated violation? Well, what they say is if the specific or closely related violation occurred at the same facility within the past 3 years, or if you're an owner of several different facilities and it's part of a pattern at multiple facilities by the same entity within the past 5 years, then you're ineligible under the policy. And there's actually a definition of what a violation is even under that, because you know, a lot of times if you're writing an audit policy letter and your client thinks you might thinks they have an issue, but it's not necessarily even proven. But because of the standard is more loosey-goosey, where you're, you know, we have a reasonable basis to believe there's a violation. Well, under this component, it has to be non-compliance with federal, state, or local environmental laws that were identified either in a judicial or administrative order, a complaint, a notice of violation, conviction, or a plea agreement. So any of those more official documents that say you have violated, or we, the agency believes you have violated. So that's what violation means under there. Or if it's something where you've already received penalty mitigation. So if you've already had problem X, and you've already said to the agency, well, we're disclosing X and we want to take advantage of the policy. You can't do that again if it's within the past 3 years at the same facility, or in the past 5 years in multiple facilities operated by the same entity. So there are other violations that are excluded from the policy. If there are violations that result in serious actual harm, present an imminent and substantial endangerment, or they violate an administrative or judicial order or consent agreement, then they're automatically excluded from the policy, and you can't disclose those and take advantage of the audit policy. And then finally, the last condition is cooperation with the agency. So a lot of times you'll write an audit policy letter and you'll get something back that says, we need more information. We don't know, you know, we want proof that this was an environmental audit situation and not just something you found out just on your own by accident. Or we want more information as far as what sampling was done, etc. You have to cooperate with EPA. If they ask you for information and you tell them no way, then they're going to deny you eligibility under the policy. So let's go through some new developments under the audit policy. The first is how audit policies are going to be applied to new owners. And I have represented a lot of companies who are in sort of merger situations, or where they're, you know, buying a new facility. And they want to know, well, what's going to happen if, you know, we find out that there are all sorts of environmental violations? And there are a lot of ways within the sales documents to protect your clients from that possibility, things like indemnification agreements and that sort of thing. But one way is also to take advantage of this new audit policy. What the EPA has done is they basically tailored the already existing audit policy and put in new incentives for new owners who want to make sort of a clean start at their recently acquired facilities by saying, well, things might have happened in the past under the new owner. In order to protect ourselves and not have to go through these, you know, indemnifications, et cetera, we want to go under the audit policy and disclose those to the agency. And so that's what this new interim approach, and it's an interim approach because EPA is right now taking a look at whether they're going to continue with the policy, whether they're going to change it, and so this, I mean, who knows, this policy, this interim approach may be in place for a long time, it may be in place for a short time, but it's definitely an interesting concept that new owners are going to be able to look back at what was done under the previous owners and get take advantage of the auto policy and not be penalized for those prior violations. And what's key is they have a definition of new owner. I'm not going to read it for word, but basically it has to be a total clean break. It can't be that, you know, company A is actually, you know, a subsidiary of company B and the facility was transferred and now I want to take advantage of the audit policy. It really does have to be a new owner, a clean break between ownership to take advantage of this tailored audit policy. Something new and interesting in this realm is the issue of e-disclosure. So the way that a disclosure typically takes place is you write a formal letter to US EPA, and there are different contacts you can find on the website depending on what region you're in. And it takes a while for the agency to read it over and determine what to do. And to take advantage, I guess, of new technology and to speed up the process, they have something where you can disclose over the internet. And right now, it's only for specific purposes. Right now, facilities nationwide can disclose EPCRA, Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act violations. And that's probably because of just the what EPCRA involves, you know, getting people to know, you know, what's, you know, explosion happened in your facility, a massive leak of chemicals, something along those lines. E-disclosure speeds up the process, and so if you're telling people about it, that, you know, the agency sees that as a good thing. It also applies to Region 6 states, so Arkansas, Louisiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas. Facilities in those states can disclose any violations of environmental laws through the e-disclosure policy. Now let's talk about state environmental audit laws. Now, there are many different forms of environmental audit laws, and we'll talk about Illinois. But the most important question you can ask about, you know, clients as well, should be disclosed. You need to find out what state the facility's in and what that state's audit policy is, because it can make a big difference. Some states make you actually provide notice for a certain period of time before you conduct an environmental audit to take advantage of state environmental audit policies. Illinois is not one of those states. So you really do need to check into the different state environmental audit laws to determine whether your client can even take advantage of the audit law. And actually, Illinois' law is very similar to the US EPA policy. The audit law is found within Section 42I of the Illinois Environmental Protection Act. It's actually within the penalty portion of the statute. And just like the federal policy, provides incentives for voluntary self-compliance to the Illinois EPA of noncompliance. And the benefits actually mirror what you have under US EPA's audit policy. So there were really two key differences between US EPA and Illinois' audit law. The first is you have to disclose noncompliance within 30 days of discovery, and noncompliance has to be corrected and any environmental law remediated in a timely fashion, which is not very specific at all. And so So you have to be careful when you're going under this policy to make sure that there's not a lot of delay between finding out about the noncompliance and correcting and remediating the environmental harm, because you don't want to get put into that trap. So that's all I had for you. Does anyone have any questions for me?
What if your experience has been under Illinois law about the 100%? You know, if you need the Illinois didn't really lay out the whole not in criteria thing.
No, actually, looking under the statute, it's just like the audit policy under EPA. There's not as much explanation because it's a statute.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the conditions are practically the same, and they lay out the 9 conditions within the statute. I can send you a copy of it, but yeah, I mean it's laid out the same. The benefits are practically the same, but as I said, that's not true across the country.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to be careful, and it's sometimes hard to hunt and peck on the internet and try to find where the audit policies are. You have to find out whether there is an agreement between US EPA and the local. The state agency to determine, well, if I disclose under the US EPA policy, will that be good enough for the state and vice versa? So it's very important if you're going to disclose under state audit policy or law to really read that and make sure you know where it's going to be applicable. And another issue that is tangentially related is, why would you do both, or when do you do one or the other? And I guess my advice is, it really depends on the situation. If you know that you have a violation under both state and federal, as a lawyer, it's out of an abundance of caution to do both. But sometimes clients don't want to do that. I had a client wanted to disclose just under the Texas regulations, under the Texas law, and that's all they wanted to do. They had no interest in doing it under the EPA. And I think part of the reason was they had a relationship with the local people. They knew the inspectors. They had a relationship with them, the state agencies, so they knew they would be okay. And so... sometimes it depends on the client what they want to do.
What is your experience with the interpretation of objectively reasonable basis? Do they give you more benefit of doubt, or if you have any sort of scintilla of idea that you're non-compliant, you should say they expect you to tell?
No, I don't think it's just. I don't think it's scintilla.
Okay.
I think you get a little more leeway than that. I mean, it really depends on the situation.
Have you been argued?
Have you
had any experience?
I haven't. Has anyone else around the table had an experience with that? Yeah, I mean, my advice is to. It does not have to be where you absolutely know that there's a violation, where you have, sampling in front of you that says, XYZ, we violated. No doubt about it. But there are sometimes you have a hint where, something really smells bad in the facility, or there was an explosion or a fire or something where, you don't have necessarily, documentary proof or scientific proof, but you know that there's an issue, then that time starts to run. And basically it's giving you enough information for you to look further, and that's why you have that window where you don't have to, you don't have 5 days. You have longer than that. And that's because, EPA doesn't have the time to look through, small little things where we may have a violation, we have not, but we're going to disclose because, we want to give you a hard time. They only want to know about violations, for sure. And that's why, you're taking advantage of the policy anyway. Does that answer your question?
Sure.
Okay.
I had a question.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned there might be a way to take advantage even if it's not discovered through an audit.
Right.
Is that, just take partial advantage of the audit policy, or
right. So if you don't discover the violation through either an audit or a compliance management system, which is that first condition, you can get 75% off the penalty. And that's discussion you want to have with your client. I mean, it also depends on how big the penalty is going to be, right? So if you're looking under the penalty policy and you find out this is a really huge penalty, and it makes sense, even at a 75% rate, to disclose, then that makes a lot of sense. But if it's going to be a small penalty, at least you think it's going to be, and it might make sense just to say, we just found it out. It wasn't through an audit. It wasn't through a compliance management situation, so we may not want to disclose. Ultimately, I think that's probably a business decision for the client to make.
I think it also depends on whether or not the non-compliance is going to be self-reported in some time in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the violations. You often find companies that fail to file Tier 1, Tier 2 reports for a facility. And then they recognize it, and then they're going to be submitting that report for the first time. That's kind of, in essence, self-disclosure. When EPA gets that, they look at the file, they go, boy, this facility's been around for 20 years. I don't have anything on this facility, so I know that there was probably not compliance. So I think that's a big factor in determining, do you try and avail yourself of the audit policy, not in a situation where it's not discovered through a systematic audit.
Good point. Any other questions? Yes.
You mentioned that EPA generally can't use the disclosure on the audit policy as a pretext to look back at historical potential non-compliant facilities. Is there a general record-keeping requirement, though, under the audit policy? I presume, once you disclose, there's not a mandatory reply date by EPA or the state agency, so there has to be some type of retention requirement, or...
Right, so the question is whether there's a record-keeping requirement under the audit policy. I don't think there is, but it's to your advantage to keep those documents. Because basically, if EPA comes back and says, look, we don't believe you. We don't think it was an audit. We think it was a more serious violation. You want to have documentation to back up what you're saying to EPA. So even though EPA, the audit policy doesn't say you have to keep it, I think you should. You should have backup information and documents for your disclosure, even if you're not going to submit that to the agency with your initial letter. You want to have that backup, absolutely. Anything else? Great. Well, thank you so much for coming. I hope it was helpful.